Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke, and my first guest today is King County Executive Dow Constantine, the mayor of King County, basically. Should we just call you that?
President of King County,
President.
Whatever you prefer.
I mean, companies have a lot of executives, but there's only one mayor, and you are the executive of 2+ million people.
Yeah, I actually have to use that term to explain to general audiences. I met with some Cub Scouts last night, and you have to explain a lot what a county executive is because they just think it's an employee. It's like a hired CEO, and it's not.
How do you describe yourself to Cub Scouts?
You know, the mayor of the county.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay, so we're at Cub Scout level. That's a good place to start. You're responsible for a bunch of stuff, and we're going to get into some of that. We're going to talk taxes and homelessness. I want to begin with the county's plans for a new juvenile justice center in Seattle. It's a $210 million investment approved by voters a few years ago. It's being built now next to the old juvenile justice center, and as you well know, there is vocal opposition, protesters chaining themselves to the construction fence.
Dow Constantine, if you're listening, we're ready for you to end construction and start repurposing that site to meet community needs. And until then, we will be here.
Those protesters call this the youth jail. Why does King County need this new facility?
Well, King County has long had a goal of reducing the number of kids involved in the justice system, including the number detained.
And in fact, you stated the goal being zero.
Yes, and we have last year set the goal of zero, which is at this point aspirational because you have to do a lot of really deep work, community work, government work to be able to even hope to get to that point. But over the course of the last 20 years, we've reduced the number of kids in detention from around 200 on an average day to this last Friday, there were 34.
How has the county done that?
Well, by preventing kids from becoming involved in the justice system in the first place, but also by creating new opportunities to divert kids into community programs that can get to the underlying challenges they have, and hopefully reduce recidivism. There are a couple things we know. One is that trauma in youth, unfairness that happens to kids when they're very young, can ultimately lead to the behaviors that alienate them from school, get them kicked out, or they drop out and get into trouble and into the justice system. And the second thing we know is that traditional detention is in and of itself traumatic. And
what is traditional detention?
Just like jail, right? Mm-hmm. And it tends, and by state law, the purpose of juvenile detention is not punishment, it's not retribution, it is rehabilitation. But in having kids in a traditional detention setting, it is traumatic, as you might imagine, and that tends not to reduce recidivism, not to reduce future crime, but rather to potentially increase the chances that people continue to act out. So you want to find a way, while you're engaging that kid, while you're trying to keep them from acting out again as they have and hurting someone else, to provide the therapy, provide the interventions that will help them get on track. We have worked over these two decades and very much in recent years to create the kinds of programs that will allow young people to be in a safe environment and to get the community mentoring, the help with whatever challenges they may be having in order that they can get their lives on track and be able to live a productive adult life. So here we are with fewer than 50 kids in detention at any given time. The community advocates for child welfare came together almost a decade ago and said, this ramshackle collection of buildings and programs that we have scattered throughout the county for kids who are going through dependency proceedings and fostering, as well as kids involved in the criminal justice system, is not adequate to our high aspirations.
Why wouldn't you scatter these services throughout the county?
Well, you can scatter the diversion programs, but the courts, the specific interventions that require the government services need to be in a place where you can bring the family together. And that was the thesis of the child welfare advocates. To help the families heal, even if the kid's involved in the criminal justice system, so that they can support this child in getting back on track. So they put together a proposal called the Children and Families Justice Center, about a little less than 17% of which is replacement of the old, very large 212-bed decrepit detention facility with a smaller, much more therapeutic, and more respectful facility. So if kids do need to be detained, they're in a place that is less traumatizing and more likely to help them get back on track.
How is it more respectful? By the way, we're talking about a facility right next to the old one in the Central District in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I know you've talked about that this, a well-built facility can help you toward that goal of fewer and fewer kids.
That's right.
What do you mean? What is so respectful about? I mean, it's essentially, it's a jail. You're detaining people.
It has detention. You cannot leave until the judge says you can leave.
Yeah, so what's
and that is that is a function of the court system. You know, there's prosecutors and police in courts. We are tasked with providing the best environment we can for kids who they are ordering to be detained until such time as they can be safely released. Most kids who are charged with crimes are not in detention. Most kids who are charged with crimes are either in a diversion program or simply out and awaiting a court proceeding. And that is, I think, a misperception that everybody who's arrested for shoplifting or even burglary or second-degree assault, these things are in detention. Most often they are not. And the challenge with that is that while they are not in detention, we're also not helping them during the 6 or 8 months or a year before they get before a judge. And a lot of kids end up getting into worse and worse and worse trouble during that time. So we're working on new diversion programs, which we'll be able to announce shortly, that will help that group of kids, which is a large group, be able to avoid the most serious traditional adjudication in favor of something that is much more likely to help them and to protect the public over the long term.
So why, let me get back to your stated goal. You called it aspirational, mm-hmm. but the aspiration is zero youth detention. How does building this facility get you toward that goal?
Well, what it does is it does right by the kids who are there now. If we don't build the detention beds, we build the rest of the facility, the kids will be left in a large, old, decrepit facility that is, by its very nature, traumatizing. The new facility is not, you know, a place where you can simply walk out and leave, but it is a place that is much more respectful. It is much more in the nature of a therapeutic environment. And it's a place where there's much more room for the kinds of programming and the help that the kids need to be able to do better in their lives. I had it redesigned, so that it can over time be collapsed, that the secure space can be reduced and given over to community programs. So we're putting together a plan for zero youth detention. And as we're able to chunk off more and more of this and create robust community alternatives for kids, we can move the space into programming on site that can help kids and their families be able to do better.
We're talking with King County Executive Dow Constantine, and you agreed in many ways with the people who oppose this juvenile justice center. You talked about that these kids are already traumatized. They're mm-hmm. acting out. Locking them up can traumatize them further, as you said, can increase their odds of dropping out, doing time in adult prison.
Absolutely.
We didn't mention racism. Do you also agree that our youth incarceration system is inherently racist?
The entire society is racist, and that's a challenge. You know, the justice system is biased at each stage because every human being is biased, but there is bias in the education system and in the economic system and in the health system from the time that child is conceived. All of these biases continue to accumulate, and that's why I started a program called Best Starts for Kids that the voters approved about 3 years ago, and that is aimed at investing in the very youngest kids, in pregnant, at-risk women, in the families to help those kids get through those first early years with the support they need and avoiding the adverse childhood experiences and the effects of the bias, the racism that's embedded in all of our institutions. So they arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed, that we follow them through school and help them avoid the things that alienate them from the school environment and instead keep them on track to be able to be successful.
And on the subject of jail, first of all, you said that the county's reduced youth detention. It's almost 75%.
Yeah, it's very
dramatic. But the percentage of black kids sent to jail has risen. Why is that?
Even though the number has decreased substantially, because and this has happened all over the country, wherever youth detention has been decreased and lower level crimes have been sent out into alternatives, the disproportionality, racial disproportionality, has increased. And that is a result of all the things we just talked about, all of the factors that go into a kid being traumatized and a kid acting out and becoming unmoored from the structures that help them stay on track, like a school community. One of the big things we have to do, we spend a lot of time analyzing what it is we need to do to keep kids out of the system in the first place. And in addition to these very early investments, one of the big things we need to do is equip every single school and every single district with the ability to create a school community that embraces kids and helps them through problems rather than ostracizes them and excludes them. And I think that the process of restorative justice of the peacemaking circles, as good as that is at conflict resolution after the fact, really using those techniques to help build a school community where every child is valued and respected and feels that his or her classmates have their back and that they're willing to help them reconcile when they get into trouble, is critical to preventing kids from wandering off and getting into trouble with the law.
On the subject of this new facility, this juvenile justice center, why not send a message in line with everything you're saying about the inherently biased, traumatizing, racist system, and take that money and instead renovate the current facility?
Well, it's more expensive to renovate the old crummy facility, and you still get a worse product at the end, right? So if you build the new, much smaller, much better facility that is reducible over time, and you get rid of the old one, the kids who have to be there now because we don't have alternatives for kids who are involved in serious violent crimes that also protect the public, the kids who have to be there now are having a much less traumatizing experience, one that is more likely to help them transition more quickly back into life, a successful life. And I conceivably could make the choice to just leave them in the old building, put a new coat of paint on it. You don't save any money. I mean, this costs are sunk already. You turn the new planned detention facility into office or some other kinds of programs. You've netted nothing other than kids who are still sitting in an old, very jail-like facility. And what we want to do is focus on the important things, which is building the community alternatives that are going to help kids have the best chance of succeeding while still protecting the public. When kids are acting, when teens are acting out, as they sometimes do, and often violently.
And that is a state law, right, that requires King County to have a juvenile detention center.
And also, yes, it's a state law, but I want to focus on the substance and not on the fact that somebody else requires us to do this. I think that...
Well, opponents to the center are saying, change the state law.
Yeah,
Would you support that?
Yeah, sure. You still don't... You don't escape the fact that there are kids who are engaged in behavior that really requires us to keep them from hurting someone else while we try to intervene.
This is King County Executive Dow Constantine. So you would support doing away with this state law? Are you lobbying against this state law that requires a King County juvenile detention
center? No, we would support. There's no reason for us to have the state require us to have this, because our goal ultimately is to move to a model where we have minimal, like, secured detention and maximum adults, responsible adults surrounding kids who are in trouble to help them get back on the right path. And I'm still exploring this model, but there's a model in another part of the country, Missouri, where they have a decentralized system across the state for juvenile detention. And most of it is highly trained social workers, professionals, mentors surrounding these kids very intensively. They still have, doors with locks on them. But they try to minimize the use of those to really only the kids who are so out of control that they're going to hurt someone else in there or get out and hurt someone in the community. And by moving toward that kind of model, and again, we're putting together our plan for zero youth detention, led by my deputy executive, Rhonda Berry. It's her full-time job now. Mm-hmm. By moving toward that kind of a model, we're going to be able to reduce the centralized detention facility and increase the community-based, community-involved programs that ultimately will give us, I think, the best chance for every kid.
One more question, I think, on Juvenile Justice Center or youth jail. I mentioned the opposition to the project most recently at your State of the County address, which you gave in a video this year, rather than deliver it with the protesters there. A spokesperson with the No New Youth Jail Coalition told the Seattle Times, quote, "We think the cancellation and the closed-door meeting shows his continued unaccountable approach over the last 6 years." Have you sat down with the youth jail opponent?
Yeah, you know what? We go, when they go out and protest, we go and ask them to come and sit down and talk. They don't want to talk. They don't want to talk because it runs against their strategy of having a single mantra of no new youth jail.
Are you inviting them to talk down?
Yes,
absolutely. On KU, in the studio that you're sitting in?
I am happy to have a real conversation that doesn't involve people standing around yelling anytime. That is the
I think our show has some room on Thursday.
That is you in. That is the one thing that I would love to be able to do and is to have a clear presentation to the public about what we are working on, because we don't have any disagreement about the origins of teen violence or of youth acting out. We don't have any disagreement about the effect of detention or incarceration on kids. We don't have any argument about the ultimate goal. What we have an argument about is whether today, in the middle of April 2018, we can do without detention entirely, because we clearly can't. So we have a choice. Old, lousy detention building, or someplace new that's much better for the kids. Well, that's it right now.
I think the most prominent juvenile justice center opponent, Nikita Oliver, said she was going to debate with you on the Seattle Channel, but you didn't want to have opponents there. And she's saying, you know, they've been shut out of the process too much already.
Well, first of all, Seattle Channel called. They said, "Do you want to come in?" I said, "Sure, we're doing that this week." And she didn't want to do it. That's fine. Not my problem.
Okay. Well, we have an invitation, as you heard, to the opponents of the Juvenile Justice Center to come and talk with us here on KOW with the King County Executive, Dow Constantine. Okay, so we hope to hear from you. Dow Constantine coming back after a short break. Can we talk about other things?
If you'd like to, sure.
Excellent, I would. Stay tuned to KOW's The Record. A couple of your questions included. On KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke with the King County Executive, Dow Constantine. We were talking about the Juvenile Justice Center. This is tangentially related. There was a protest over the detention center last month that blocked downtown Seattle traffic, and Seattle police did not immediately make arrests, and the protests went on for hours. But your sheriff told KTTH that she would have done it differently.
On that day, I worked remotely because my office is down there, and there was no way I was going to get to it, and some other staff having 2 and 3 hour commutes that day. So, you know, each agency decides how to handle things differently.
And what about in your jurisdiction?
In my jurisdiction, if the roadway is blocking, then we would make arrests.
That's the King County Sheriff, Mitzi Johanknick, saying in her jurisdiction, King County, you arrest those protesters. So on Twitter, G. Todd Williams wanted to know about this. He wants to ask you, why let protesters stop traffic for hours? Why not move them to the curb if you don't want to arrest them? That was a question for Seattle. Should police, do you think, move more quickly to clear up street protests?
I mean, yeah, that is a question for Seattle. Yeah. In King County, the sheriff's separately elected, so she has her own authority. Police chief works for the mayor and by extension, city council.
What do you think?
I think that protesters should be moved to the sidewalk. And the rule in Seattle is you can protest on the sidewalk, but you need a permit to protest in the street or march in the street. Obviously, there's going to be a certain amount of patience or leeway, but it's not reasonable to allow people to block the streets all day. And I think that probably when that happens again, there will be a different approach. But again, you know, measured and trying to make sure people have the ability to make their voices heard while not shutting down the you know, people's daily lives.
And in fairness to the Seattle police chief, she said it wouldn't have happened all day in Seattle either. We weren't going to let them stay to rush hour, right, which they didn't. Right. One more policing question from a KUOW listener named Mark, who writes, there was an incident 8 months ago when a plainclothed King County detective pulled his gun and confronted a motorcyclist he felt was driving illegally. The rider had a GoPro. The confrontation was recorded and published. Yesterday, the sheriff suspended the detective for 5 days. And Mark says, from my perspective, it seems like a token punishment for something largely created by the improper escalation of the detective. Did you think that was a reasonable punishment?
You know, I haven't had a chance to talk with the sheriff about that. I actually learned about it watching it on TV. I did see the original incident on video, and it was startling. And so,
this officer's again, pointing a gun,
yeah,
and saying, I didn't know that my gun was pointed where it was pointed.
So, again, I'm not the boss of the King County Sheriff, but I will ask the sheriff what the rationale is for that particular sanction. And I'm sure she thought about it carefully because she knows what the consequences are in terms of public perception for any decision she would have made.
A couple quick follow-ups from Mark. Very thorough, Mark. What oversight do you have over the behavior of the King County Sheriff's Department? You answered that. You said none?
Not directly. There's a council-created and managed organization called the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight. And it has some powers, but a lot of authority is still reserved because it needs to be negotiated with the Police Officers Guild.
Okay.
And so
that sounds like Seattle, too. There's a guild.
Yeah. And so that is a continuing challenge for the person who's in charge of what's known as OLEO. But again, that is a council. There are a few agencies that are actually managed by the legislative branch, and that's one of them.
Mark also says, finally, are there plans to require all enforcement-based employees to wear and use body cameras?
That is something that we brought up several times with the previous sheriff, and you know, this new sheriff is still getting settled in, but I personally think it's a good idea. I think that more information, the better. It helps get to the bottom of whatever issue's happening. It also helps exonerate officers that they're being falsely accused. Accused of misbehavior. So I am very much in favor of that.
Another question from a listener. Eileen asks, will you ask Dow Constantine if Sound Transit has any plans to eliminate the rail route along the east shore of Puget Sound from Everett to Seattle because it's closed so often due to mudslides, which I believe it is closed again today?
Yeah. It has been a continuing challenge on the railroad tracks. If those are not Sound Transit owned tracks, but it's been a continuing challenge there. It's a difficult route. Ultimately, we'll have more, or my successors will have more decisions to make when the light rail gets to all the way up to Everett, because that's where that commuter rail section starts. But there are a lot of communities that are along the shoreline there that would be quite remote from that light rail line. So it'll be a tough conversation to have. They need to decide whether the tracks can be made more reliable and whether they're able to build the ridership with that new reliability.
By the way, Eileen wants you to know she thinks we're better off getting rid of it, spending the money on things like buses, park and ride lots that cost less, attract more people, and don't get canceled
right.
by mudslides.
I mean, obviously, that's part of the conversation. And right now, because there's not a light rail alternative up there, it's not as immediate. But as those two lines open in parallel, there's going to be that conversation for sure.
Let's talk about homelessness now. You are working with the mayors of Seattle and Auburn to bring all the right people together to try to make some headway as a region. It's called the One Table Task Force. We got a look at their first crack at this earlier this month. The executive director of the Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness, Allison Eisinger, said the plan to build 5,000 affordable homes is not enough. She says, when I think about being bold, when I think about being strategic, when I think about being realistic about this region needs, 5,000 falls short. Do you think we need a higher goal than 5,000 affordable homes?
Well, so One Table is an attempt to bring together everyone in the community, including not just governments and service providers, but the philanthropic community, the business community, those who've experienced homelessness, to come up with a unified vision and a plan where everyone does the thing they do best to get us to our goal. The preliminary recommendations are around increasing affordable housing, treatment on demand for behavioral health, connecting people to job opportunities and having no one exit a system, whether it's the criminal justice system or the foster care system or the mental health system, into homelessness, because a lot of folks on the streets are there because they left these structured systems without a safety net and they had nothing. On the housing front, you know, this is going to have to be a solution that involves not just government-built housing or even nonprofit-built housing, but the private market, because the scale on which we need housing to be built is well beyond our either financial or physical capacity to create. So that number, 5,000, was one that's suggested by staff that could be accomplished by government in a five-year period. You need tens of thousands of units. There's a misalignment between people's ability or means in the community and the housing stock right now, because there's more dollars chasing a limited stock of housing.
So that 500 number from the one table plan, that's appropriate. 5,000, sorry. 5,000 is appropriate number for just a piece of the
The number might be 5 or it might be 10, but I think everybody, including Allison, would be skeptical of our ability just using our current structures to deliver either 5 or 10,000 units of housing in 3 years. The personnel, the land, and the money are all constraints, and we need to be realistic about it and also recognize that we're going to have to innovate and do more than we've done in the past with these traditional models of government housing. We're going to have to incent and remove barriers to the private sector providing new housing, not just in this stratum, but for people earning a little bit more, which will tend to then depress the prices for the housing those folks used to live in. As they move to new housing, we need to figure out what we can do to make sure it's not just Seattle, but all 39 cities and the unincorporated county, everywhere where there's a good transit connection, where people can build this kind of housing. And in doing that, in bringing all of our resources and every player to bear on the problem, we will be able to get ahead of it. But that's why it's critical to have everyone at the table uniting around a single vision, and that's why it's a struggle.
So these programs, affordable housing, behavioral health, job opportunities, a safety net, how's King County paying for all of this?
Well, King County is not paying for all of it. King County has a certain set of resources now, mental illness and drug dependency funding, Vets, Seniors, and Human Services levy, indeed Best Starts for Kids, where we've invested a lot in preventing youth and families.
That was another voter-approved levy.
Very successful. Yeah. We prevented some 4,000 people from becoming homeless in the last year through an innovative, very direct community-engaged program there. But the point is that King County has some funds.
Will there be a new levy?
We just got more funds from the state through an increase in the document recording fee, which we're very appreciative of.
Will there be a need for a new, say a property tax levy for homelessness?
Yeah. Clearly going to need to be more resources if we're going to be able to realize in the kind of vision we're talking about. But the first thing is to agree on what is needed. The second is to inventory the resources available. The third is to say what the gap is. And then the fourth is to figure out how we, and I would assert regionally and not just in Seattle, can raise the funds we need to fill that gap. And it could be there's a 0.1% sales tax authority that was authorized by the legislature that's countywide. There are, of course, other options. Property tax is rather oversubscribed these days because of the legislature's action on the McCleary decision.
Yes. By oversubscribed, you mean, I believe, largest one-year increase on record in property taxes in King County.
Could we talk about taxes?
I would like to talk. Okay. You know, I think that a lot of people are thinking about that, especially if you're on a fixed income and the escalating property taxes are tough on you.
Oh,
are you doing anything to help that person?
Average 17% increase in King County.
About $800 a year, I think, average.
Very much driven by the legislative action to solve the statewide education funding problem. The problem is King County residents, along with some in San Juan County, were ultimately handed the net bill for the whole thing. And so they're basing their decision about who pays on the condition of the local real estate market. And that doesn't have that much to do with your ability to pay. Your ability to pay has not gone up that much. It just means that you're struggling to hold on, to make ends meet, to be able to pay your mortgage or pay your taxes in this region where the economy has done what it's done. Not everyone's participating in that economic story. Not
right.
at all.
If you're a property owner, you're participating by sitting on a increasingly right. valuable.
But the problem there is that if you've put down roots and you're part of this community and you've bought this house and, you know, people are moving here and bidding up the price of housing and you're being handed a great big tax bill, that doesn't mean you have a penny more to pay your taxes.
You got kids, you can't just downsize and stay.
Whereas the people in another county, let's say, mm-hmm. are being subsidized by King County and they're taking that extra money that they're not putting into housing and not putting increased cost of living into investments for their retirement, into securities. And they're not paying taxes on that in this state, right? They're not paying the kind of taxes you're being asked to pay. So there's a misalignment. This old tax system under new economic conditions doesn't work. It's not fair. Needs to be changed.
What can you do to help that homeowner?
Well, what we can do, first of all, the legislature was on the cusp of doing something, which is enacting a capital gains tax for gains over $50,000 per couple, not including your primary residence, that would have gone directly to reducing this property tax hit. So some people who sell securities, for example, would pay some taxes and you would pay less on the home that you own and that you're trying to raise your kids in. And I think that's fair. Right. The question for the tax system is, how can we make it so everyone is doing their fair share? And right now, everyone's not doing their fair share. Some people are paying a lot. People who have the least money are paying a lot because of their reliance on sales tax. People whose only real asset is the home that they live in are paying a lot because of the changes in the real estate market. And others are getting by pretty cheap. And, you know, the thing people don't realize is overall state and local taxes have gone down. They've been flat or gone down over the course of the last couple of decades in this state and on a per $1,000 basis income. And that is, and it seems like taxes are worse because the system is unfair and the people who've been getting hit are just getting hit more and more and more.
So when I ask what you could do to help and your answer is, well, there was the capital gains tax idea. That didn't go anywhere.
I think we need to bring together the business community, individual taxpayers, those who are concerned about the folks who are struggling the most, and come up with some dramatic solutions for the legislature to consider, to move away from this heavy reliance on sales tax and property tax, to, in fact, move away from this strange gross receipts tax, B&O tax, with all of its loopholes and exceptions that we have for business, and to move to something that answers to the priority of being fair, adequate, stable, and good for job creation.
So you're hoping for Olympia, but no King County capital gains or income tax?
No, we don't have authority to do that. All of our authority comes from the state. And the only authority we really have is to put a property tax levy on the ballot, and they just came in and vacuumed up all the property tax capacity. So we're left with very little in the way of options.
This is King County Executive Dow Constantine. And one more question on homelessness. An audit of King County Metro Rapid Ride bus lines found homeless people often cited for fare evasion. You know, it's like sort of like where are they supposed to go? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, they're almost certainly all eligible for our ORCA Lyft card, which is for folks earning less than twice federal poverty. And we can connect them with that. There's also, for those who are most destitute, passes that they can get from human service agencies that we sell them at very deeply discounted rates to give away. And we want enforcement officers, whether it's in Sound Transit or Metro, to be taking those opportunities to sign people up for the benefits that they are eligible for.
Okay, two more questions. About opioid addiction. King County wants to give supervised drug injection sites a try where you could use heroin or other drugs alongside a medical professional. Supporters say fewer overdose deaths, fewer people using in public spaces. Snohomish and Pierce counties have banned that idea. Is King County still planning to open them, and if so, when and where?
So task force recommended 9 different approaches to help with the opioid crisis, one of which was this notion you just mentioned. There are places where you can prevent somebody from ODing, but you can also engage them to get them on to treatment, which you're not going to get if they're sitting at home in the basement or in a park or in an alley. They're in grave danger. People are dying every day in this county and in this state. And all the moralizing in the world is not going to save those lives. So
when and where?
So we it was recommended to us that we have one site in the city of Seattle, one outside Seattle. Everybody agreed we should work on Seattle first. City of Seattle is having this conversation internally about where it could be. I know it's a uncomfortable notion for folks, but I am more uncomfortable with taking the easy way out and at the same time allowing people to be at risk of ODing, dying. This is a terrible epidemic, and we just cannot tolerate that.
So somewhere in Seattle, we don't know where, and somewhere outside of Seattle, we don't know where.
Hopefully the jurisdictions outside of Seattle will be able to see that it's working, that it's not the catastrophe predicted, and that, in fact, lives are being saved and folks will be more amenable to it.
Okay. You know, the King County dumped some 30 million gallons of raw sewage near the beach at Discovery Park. Was anybody held accountable for that?
Failure of the sewage treatment plant had a very brief period of raw sewage going out. Then it was in primary treatment, so it didn't. The secondary treatment wasn't working, but it had been screened and it was being sent way far offshore. The great news is that after all the scientific studies, there was minimal impact on the sound. I mean, it was during the winter, the primary treatment was happening, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it was called a disaster at the time. And actually, as far as we know, it didn't turn out to be a disaster.
But, you know, it was a confluence, if you'll pardon the pun, of some very difficult circumstances.
Confluence of effluent.
We had power fluctuation from the power supply coming into the plant. We had one of these major rain events. We had a series of situations with the alarm systems within the plant that caused the personnel who are working as hard as they can to prevent a spill, cause them to not make all the choices they might have wanted to make to begin spilling the effluent earlier to prevent the flooding. But all of that has been the subject of a very extensive after-incident review. They've redone all the systems. They're rebuilding this plant. They did heroic work in rebuilding an entire sewage plant in a very short period of time. It's up and operating very well. But we continue to work on redundancies and the ways in which we can prevent that kind of thing from happening again. And the dangers increase with climate change, with more severe storm events, with rising tides that are going to present challenges to that plant.
If you're in King County, he's your mayor-ish, the executive, Dow Constantine. Any final message for your constituents?
Yeah, you know, we are working hard to have a government that is up to the high expectations of the people. And that means not only in terms of policy, but in terms of innovating to be able to deliver more services more effectively for the dollars available. And that is our core commitment. And we are doing very well on that. I'm very proud of our employees at King County for stepping up to the task.
King County Executive Dow Constantine has invited opponents of the new Juvenile Justice Center to come on and have a conversation on KUOW, so we look forward to that. Thank you. Finally, I just want to ask you about, you and I used to be across the hall from one another. I don't think we knew each other, but we were Huskies together when I was at KUOW and you were at then KCMU, now KEXP.
Yeah, I was across the hall with the cool kids.
With the cool kids, yeah. And I was with the nerds. Thank you. I think we have a KUOW pledge drive mug that says, like, nerd love or something like that. So, yeah, we still embrace that. It's now KEXP. You DJ'd there as a Husky, as a student.
I did.
KEXP just got maybe the biggest donation in the history of public radio or TV, $10 million from a listener named Suzanne. So having been there at the station back in the day, how should they spend it?
Well, first of all, I started out at the station making phone calls and asking for donations of like $10 and $25.
Yeah.
That's before they put me on the air. And $10 million, just inconceivable. But it is a great investment in keeping local music radio vital and vibrant. And in fact, global introduction to music that people wouldn't otherwise hear. I am so grateful to Suzanne, who passed away, for her investment. And I hope folks will appreciate that not all communities have this kind of an asset and will support it.
Anything? Any one thing a public radio station ought to spend $10 million on? A music station?
You know,
one splurge.
More music. I mean, obviously, probably their on-air personnel should be very highly paid, right?
Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly, I think we can all agree on that. Former DJ now has another job, the executive of 2.2 million people or so. Yeah. King County Executive Dow Constantine, thanks for coming in, answering questions,
thanks
listeners' questions, my questions. Let's do it again.
Love to.
Okay.
Thanks.
More of KUOW's The Record coming up. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with another story from Aurora Avenue, that aging section of Highway 99 that's headed for big changes. The most congested bus route in King County runs down Aurora. It's called the Rapid Ride E-Line. The crowding on those buses brings together all kinds of people, as KUOW's Joshua McNichols reports.
During rush hour, an E-Line bus heads south from Shoreline every 5 minutes. Nicole Fabre is at the wheel.
I drive the bus up and down Aurora. That's what I do, is I drive the bus up and down Aurora.
The route is a straight shot down 99, past parking lots and seedy motels and Green Lake with its joggers. It keeps on going past Amazon's South Lake Union, and it ends in the Stadium District near a bunch of homeless shelters. Casey Stevens gets on at Green Lake. She says the bus picks up every kind of person you can imagine.
Oh man, it runs the gamut. You find a lot of people commuting to Amazon, like myself. You find homeless folks trying to get from whatever shelter they were staying at to wherever they're going to be during the day, and everything in between.
By the time the bus hits the Aurora Bridge, people are often squeezed together like sardines.
I do tell the passengers, when they get on and it's crowded, I tell you, if you can't fit behind the yellow line, you can't get on the bus. You have to wait for the next bus. I tell them. Of course, they try to do it, but I always tell them, no, it's not. We're not going to pack like that. It's not going to work.
When you're all pushed up against each other, you can see the best and worst of people. Chris Haramoto is a junk hauler. He boards the E-Line at its northernmost stop.
There's not really any bad things about it, except for the occasional crazies.
And when people act out, there is definitely gawking that goes on. Elissa Gibson has a favorite person she likes to watch.
He's like the dancing guy. He dances and sings.
The whole ride?
The whole ride. I got him on a video twice.
You can smile about a guy who dances and sings, but the behaviors on the bus can also indicate untreated mental illness or other forms of distress.
Some lady punched out another lady that she had a major problem with.
One time I saw a homeless man get kicked off the bus by four cops in a wheelchair, and then he pissed on the bus stop when he got off.
I saw people smoke crack before on the bus.
I saw someone pull out a taser.
I'm okay, I have my pepper spray.
Safety incidents happen on buses all over the region, but the E-Line has the second highest number of incidents. And still, it's Metro's most popular route, and it's also one of the fastest growing.
I don't know, I think it's a refuge for a lot of people.
Jeffrey Webb is homeless. He's on the E-Line to get warm.
You know, it's almost like a warming center for you at that time, where you will, rather than, I mean, I've walked by a building, and I don't do that, but walked by a building and just wondered if it was warmer than there than it was on out on the street, wanted to break the window.
So he could climb inside the building and get warm, but instead he climbs on this bus. When he can't pay the fare, he just doesn't. Sometimes fare enforcers catch people who slip in without paying. Ezgi Choban watches it happen from her seat in the back.
It seems like the people who seem to get most punished are like the poor people who can't afford to pay the fare. And that's kind of upsetting to me.
As for the bus driver, she doesn't judge her passengers.
They don't bother me none at all. As long as everybody's good to each other on the bus, that's all that matters to me. As long as we can get from point A to point B without any issues, that's all that matters to me.
From the bus that goes up and down Aurora, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Later this week, the Region of Boom team will be following Highway 99 into downtown Seattle, and you can follow the whole series called Along the Mother Road at KUOW.org. Another ongoing story we've been telling you about is this oil pipeline between Alberta and Vancouver, BC, the Kinder Morgan pipeline that Seattle kayakers protested last month. Well, Kinder Morgan has suspended construction on this pipeline expansion. So now what? Here is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Now what?
Is now
right.
What?
Bill, his word came out of Texas 10 days ago. Kinder Morgan headquarters said they're tired of the uncertainty around the project. They were getting ready to start spending $200 or $300 million a month this summer building the thing. Instead, they put it on hold, and they've given Canadian governments till the 31st of May to sort out the uncertainty, or they're walking away from a project that is going to cost, well, $7.5 billion Canadian, which is a lot of money even in American dollars.
Yes. So you said summer construction, but the deadline is May 31st. So is this is Kinder Morgan really giving anything up here?
I think they're pretty serious at this point. They've reached the point where they're going to have to commit very large dollars. The construction season begins in the summer, and still not certain. The British Columbia government is opposed to the project. It actually doesn't have the legal power to stop it, but it can make it expensive to build it. They can delay it. They can hold it up. And so the company said, look, basically the Canadian government, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, get this thing sorted out or we're walking away. Trudeau took them seriously. He summoned the Premier of Alberta, Rachel Notley, and the Premier of British Columbia, John Horgan, to Ottawa for a meeting Sunday morning. It wasn't an easy day to get in and out of our national capital. It was an ice storm, but they had a big meeting. They didn't entirely sort things out, but a couple of things are happening. The one that's probably the most interesting is Trudeau says the National Government of Canada is so determined to get this thing built that they are going to enter into negotiations with the company in Texas to either indemnify them for any financial risk of going ahead, and Canada is exploring the possibility of buying a piece of the pipeline, maybe even taking over the whole thing. The province of Alberta, which has the oil, say they will join in that as well. So we may end up with a project that's being built in whole or in part by Canadian governments come summer.
A lot of Washington state politicians oppose the pipeline expansion because it would send many more oil tankers through our waters, including, though, to Washington state refineries. You mentioned BC's premier opposes the expansion, so maybe you should remind us why your generally environmentalist Prime Minister Trudeau supports it.
He sees it as part of a deal that will allow the country's climate action plan to go ahead. We have a national carbon pricing scheme. It involves as well expanding the profit we make on oil production. Right now, we're captive of the American market, and with the huge expansion of shale oil production in the United States, we're not getting the best possible price. So the idea is you twin this pipeline to Vancouver, you load the stuff on tankers, you sell it to other countries in Asia where the price is better, and because the economy is stronger and then doing better, we can afford to pay the carbon taxes and reduce emissions in other sectors of the Canadian economy. As you will know, oil production, some of the emissions are in the countries that burn the stuff. Not all the emissions are in the country that produces it.
Yeah, that's right. This oil comes from Alberta, which is angry about BC's opposition. So I understand Alberta is talking about cutting off shipments of oil and gasoline and natural gas to British Columbia?
Yeah, this thing takes a new twist every day. Yesterday, the Alberta government tabled a piece of legislation that would allow the government of Alberta, under a licensing scheme, to withhold permits to ship oil, natural gas, and gasoline to British Columbia. So the threat there is if they cut off shipments, it would drive up the price of gasoline in British Columbia, and it would be targeted. So they could continue to send oil through the pipeline to the refineries in Washington state, but they would withhold permitting to send the oil to British Columbia. So the feeling is it might drive up the price of gasoline significantly in British Columbia. The Alberta government, by the way, Bill, is saying they're not necessarily going to use this legislation. They're just going to hold it back as a threat if British Columbia does anything more to try to stop this project.
Okay, a threat to BC, not a threat to Washington state refineries.
That's right.
And finally, we have 1 minute left, Vaughn. is BC, you said they don't really have the power to block this. So
they do not have the power because federal jurisdiction in Canada over interprovincial projects, over ports, and over pipelines is clear, but the province does have some say over the management of the environment and protection of coastal waters, and the province is asking the courts to clarify how far they can go. The courts will probably say, you can add regulations and conditions and safety measures, you can't stop the project outright, but the as I said, the province is asking the courts to clarify that power.
Okay, and Kinder Morgan, a Texas company, by the way, is saying they are suspending construction on this pipeline expansion unless they get some certainty that it's actually going to happen. They've set a May 31st deadline, so we'll see. Vaughn Palmer, columnist at Vancouver Sun, thanks a lot.
We'll be back to this subject again.
I'm sure we will.
Thank you.
Yes, that's it for today, though, from The Record, produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. And coming up tomorrow, Starbucks will close 8,000 stores for an afternoon so its 175,000 employees can attend racial bias training. But does racial bias training work? We're going to talk with someone who's spent years researching the effects of racial bias training. That's tomorrow on The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.